How many terrorist attacks have you survived? What about breast cancer? What about being poisoned by anthrax? I'm hoping that you said no to all of the above. But for today's guest, Dr. Nina Cerfolio, she can check off each of those. You could basically say that this woman is about to present you with a masterclass in resilience. I welcome you to episode 274. What's up, my friend, and welcome to Grit, Grace, and Inspiration. I am your host, Kevin Lowe. 20 years ago, I awoke from a life-saving surgery, only to find that I was left completely blind. And since that day, I've learned a lot about life, a lot about living, and a lot about myself. And here on this podcast, I want to share those insights with you. Because, friend, if you are still searching for your purpose, still trying to understand why, or still left searching for that next right path to take, well, consider this to be your stepping stone to get you from where you are to where you want to be. Curious, how did you sleep last night? Me, I slept like a baby, all thanks to our brand new sponsor, MyPillow. If you are in the market to upgrade your sleep routine, I'm talking a new pillow, some luxurious sheets, maybe a mattress topper that's going to have you swearing you just slept on a brand new mattress, then I'm telling you, MyPillow is the place to be. Use the promo code Kevin at checkout to be sure you get the best available price when shopping at MyPillow.com. Remember, that's promo code Kevin, and that's going to save you up to 80% off any of their more than 250 products. And remember this, you're not only going to be purchasing top-notch, high-quality products, not only saving up to 80%, but you're also going to be supporting an American-owned and operated company in addition to supporting this very podcast. Remember, head on over to MyPillow.com and use promo code Kevin to get up to 80% off. It's time that you start sleeping like a baby, too.
I'm a psychiatrist, and I am actually a mass shooting terrorist trauma expert. So early in childhood, I think I always was interested in understanding myself and other people and what made them do the things they did. So I always think I was very psychologically minded and motivated in terms of understanding human behavior. But more recently in my adulthood, I survived two terrorist attacks. One was I was a first responder down to 9/11. I made a conscious decision to go down there and to help survivors. And what it turned out being was helping other first responders and family members that had somehow gotten down there. You know, they had lost loved ones. And then as a consequence of being a first responder, I developed breast cancer and had a mastectomy, and continue to be a patient as a breast cancer patient under guidance of a great, great oncologist, actually. I'm very blessed. And then in 2005, I chose to go into the second Chechen war and genocide. So just to give a brief background of Chechnya, because people often don't know where it is or its history, which is very complicated, but Chechnya is a part of Russia. It's in the North Caucasus, which has the tallest, Mount Elbrus is the tallest mountain range in Europe. And it's very rich with oils and minerals. And the Chechens have been trying to be independent from Russia since Catherine the Great. And they're often portrayed by Russians as being terrorists, even though, in my experience, they're Muslim and there are these farmers who are loving and would give you the shirt off of their back. They're just the most loving, loyal people. And I chose to go into the Second Chechen War. So Putin had waged war with Chechnya early in the early 90s, and this is what brought him into power. And there was an incident called the apartment building bombings in Russia, where in seven cities, apartment buildings were demolished by bombs that were planted. Hundreds were killed, thousands were injured. And Putin blamed these bombings on the Chechens. And it turned out that Putin actually was the KGB, was the one who planted them. I don't know if you remember Alexander Levantenko, but he was the defected KGB agent who went to London and was killed by radioactive iodine. And he basically came forth and said that he and others were the ones that, as a KGB agents, planted the bombs, and which was blamed on Chechens. And also, there was the last apartment bombing. There were people that were community members that were being hypervigilant and checking for bombs at this point. And these community members found bombs underneath an apartment building. They were found to only have been, the materials could only have been put there by the KGB. They obviously disassembled them. And then Putin said that this was an exercise that the KGB were practicing. But it's a long story and it's very complicated. But to make it short, he went into Chechnya and started bombing civilians and killed probably over 200,000 civilians. And I chose to go there at the time in 2005. It was the most dangerous place on earth. It was largely internationally ignored. And America actually joined forces with Putin in the war against terrorism. So as a consequence of that war, he's just continued on because there was no protest really by the West or by the world. And he did the same thing in Syria, in Georgia, and now in Ukraine. Although the world has, at least for a moment, seemingly woke up with Ukraine, and the West has given a lot of money for ammunition and backing for Ukraine. So that is at least good. But when I was in Chechnya, it was a total genocide. It was It was Gaza Strip times 100.
Yeah. Wow. So back up a ways for me, though, back to 9/11 was this first big event. And so my understanding when you talked about with your career as a psychiatrist, you were really in the field of dealing with this type of situation, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. So I had been in academic medicine. I ran the psychiatric emergency room and walk-in clinic. So for about 5 years, I taught residents and medical students. So I always was really in the trenches and dealing with people that had been arrested or murderers or psychotic people often that didn't get proper psychiatric treatment that then became violent. Yes. So although I've always had a private practice as well, but my expertise is in trauma. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm curious, when 9/11 happened, would you mind sharing with me a little bit about that story as far as your experience? Where were you and what you were able to do?
Yes, I would love to. So the day of 9/11, I'll never forget it. There wasn't a cloud in the sky in Manhattan. I was walking to see a patient at 8 a.m. The first tower was already hit and on fire. And there were rumors that there was a plane, like a small plane that went in, but it was like an accident. And I'll never forget, my patient said, this was a terrorist attack. And then throughout the day, most of my patients canceled because public transport was stopped, so they couldn't get to me. So a few of my patients I did see on that day, and we shared the trauma together, but I was literally in the street in front of my office. So my office was on University Place, and that's about a mile away from the towers. And I was an elite endurance athlete at the time. I was running marathons. I ran my first marathon in 2001. So my training route actually was to run down the West Side Highway, past the towers, the tip of Manhattan to the east side and back. It was about a 10-mile loop. And the towers really, for me, were a symbol of resilience and strength. They had been bombed earlier in 1993, and they withstood that bombing. A bomb was placed in the parking lot. But to me, they were also my running companions. I always looked to them in terms of getting a sense of direction, and they always seemed to instill energy in me when I was really tired from a full day of patients. So I saw the towers, both the towers come down when I was standing on University Place, which was a street in front of my office. I saw people walking away from the towers covered in dust. They looked like ghosts. They were in shock. I witnessed people were trying to get news what was going on. You couldn't really get a dial on your cell phone because it was so overwhelmed with all the calling. So people were trying to call loved ones. They couldn't get through. So people were listening on the radios for news as what had happened. And then we learned that there was also the attack on our capital in DC. And it was, I can't even really put it in words. It was a horror film, you know, to see the towers come down. And it, literally there were 100 people gathered on the street and we all collectively gasped. Like we all couldn't believe what we saw. It was really mind-boggling because I never thought the towers would come down. Like they literally came down like pancakes, floor by floor, like they enveloped inwards. And the next day I decided that because a lot of my patients also had canceled because they couldn't come to me, I decided that I would go down and help people. So I packed lunch, I packed water, also extra water for people, blankets for people that needed them, and put on my work boots and went down there. And getting down there, I had to cross several checkpoints. And really the only time I processed any fear was after I passed a checkpoint in Soho. And initially the police didn't want to believe I was a doctor. At the time I was in my 40s and I looked very young. And I had to prove to them that I was a doctor. So they let me through. And Soho was a ghost town. You could literally hear a pin drop. I've never heard New York City so quiet, ever. Mm. It was quiet after Trump won, but not like this. This was like a vacuum of silence.
Yeah.
And a voice said to me, you know, turn around and run, because everyone had left Soho. Most people had evacuated. But I continued down and then I started moving debris. It was unrecognizable down there. It was fires going on and stacks of debris, like 10, 12 stories high. There was ash raining. I don't even remember the color of the ash. There was a toxic, noxious smell to your eyes, to your skin. It was hard to breathe down there. Someone handed me work gloves and a surgical mask, and just spontaneously, the people that had gone down there formed a bucket brigade and started moving debris along a line. We handed it off to the next person in an attempt to look for victims under all the debris. And then eventually, I was down there the first day for about 16 hours. And there was a medical triage unit that was just spontaneously formed with other doctors. I was the only psychiatrist that went down there then. And we helped provide medical and psychiatric aid to people. I dealt with a construction worker who was having anxiety because he had built the World Trade Center and then he had gone down with his crane and couldn't find any survivors. He was having extreme anxiety. And actually, somehow we had medication there. I was able to give him some Ativan and to talk to him for a while. And eventually he was able to go back to work to look for survivors. I also was asked to see family members who were disturbing the rescue process. They were insisting that their loved one, they had last spoken to them at a certain point under the World Trade Center, and they wanted rescuers to go look for them. So I had to work with them to try to support them so that they would be better able to really accept that most likely they weren't going to find their loved one at this point, which they didn't. Other like firemen getting them medical help as well. So yeah, it was really a radically unifying experience of all these first responders who came together to help our brothers and sisters. And we really rose above the horror, the devastation, the death, the loss, the injury, the sorrow. And it was, for me, a very spiritual experience.
Yeah, absolutely. One question that I am wondering about is, here you are, a psychiatrist. You're there to help others. Was there a moment in time, whether down at Ground Zero or maybe back at home when you broke down yourself?
That's a great question. So I was brought up to not show any emotion, to super perform. I was expected to be a good little Catholic girl, not express my feelings, but super perform in sports. And luckily, I was a natural athlete. A lot of people in my family are natural athletes, but I was expected to super perform at sports, often not being given the proper tools to do so as well, but to rise above that in at school as well. It's sort of my parents' motto was, you know, we're going to break you down, but then they never really built us back up. Kind of like in the military, they break you down, but then they build you back up. My parents would break us down, but not really build us back up. So I was a person that grew up, it's called counterphobia in psychiatry, which is where you go into your fears and you overcome them. So because I felt unseen, unloved, unworthy in my childhood, I felt that I needed to constantly super perform or super achieve to overcome those feelings. So to answer your question, no, I never really had a breakdown or processed or cried. What I did have was recurrent nightmares of planes flying into buildings, buildings collapsing, people jumping out of burning buildings. These things I did have recurrent nightmares, but I never had a breakdown or cried or processed my sorrow there. I mean, I have subsequently, I think, in my own therapy, but not like I know some people that went down there who were psychologists started having a breakdown there. They couldn't process and they had to leave. I very much was brought up, so to speak, in an emotional war. So going into a war for me was a reflex. It was something that I knew too well. So it wasn't unfamiliar to me at all. It was how I was brought up. So no, to answer your question, no. Other yeah. than with flashbacks and nightmares, mm-hmm. yes.
Yeah, understandable. My other question is did you find yourself in the years after 9/11 working with a lot of people who were directly impacted by the terrorist attacks, whether by losing a loved one or were there themselves?
Absolutely. I had many patients that worked down there. I had a lovely female patient who had just gotten married. She didn't like New York City, who hated working in the World Trade Center buildings. She was trapped in the second building and was told to stay at her desk. And luckily, she didn't listen. She hated the world buildings. She found them really claustrophobic and hated working in them. And luckily, she didn't listen to what she was told. And her and her coworkers left and narrowly escaped the second building collapsing. And then I also had patients who lost their father, who worked for... So Cantor Fitzgerald was a Wall Street investment firm. And it was impacted. The first plane literally flew into the floor that the Cantor Fitzgerald was on. So no one was ever found from that firm who worked there on that day. My patient's father, they never found his body. And I worked with her for many, many years. And 12 years after 9/11, they found a humerus on top, like the bone in the arm, humerus. On top of a building, a high-storied building in Manhattan downtown, and it turned out to be her father's bone, like DNA. So, you know, most people that lost loved ones down there did not receive a body or a bone or any remnants of their loved ones. So yes, I had many patients that either were down there that escaped, that lost loved ones, or that worked down there and were just so traumatized by the whole event. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. My last question with direct, you know, related to 9/11 is I know that a lot of people in the years after had medical issues. Did you experience anything yourself?
Yeah. So I have difficulties breathing. I've been told that I developed asthma recently, and I wonder if it's not. I know that several many people have developed asthma from being down there. I guess I just don't even really want to know. I developed breast cancer as a result of being down there and my work down there in 2017. And I'm followed by the World Health Trade Center insurance, and they're wonderful, actually. And they basically provide care to people who have 9/11 related diseases. Many people who have developed cancer, like me, from being a first responder down there. And many people have died. So now there are many more people that have actually died from cancer-related 9/11 disorders than actual people who died during that horrible day, terrorist attack. Yes. So, wow. Yeah. Yes.
Wow. 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 Isn't that almost hard to believe?
It is. It's so hard to believe. And it's such a testament to how human spirit is so interconnected and beautiful that we're all so willing to, you know, firemen, policemen, doctors, construction workers, really put our own life on the line to go down there to help our brothers and sisters who were vulnerable and in a horrible situation and needed our help. It really is a testament to human kindness and love and interconnectedness.
Yeah, absolutely. So my next question is, you go through this experience during 9/11, what then makes you want to go over to Russia, over out of the country to pursue other endeavors? I almost would feel like you might have been like, okay, it's time for me to play it safe, but you kept going. And yeah. So I'm kind of curious what led to that.
That's a great question. So I think it would have been wise for me to process that or to think that. But at the time, I was an elite endurance athlete. I was actually winning some ultra marathons and, you know, overall, not just even in my age group. And I had won the half marathon on the China Wall in Beijing. I had placed second overall of women in the Kurt Steiner. It's a 32-mile race, and that's, you know, normal marathon is 26.2, so this is longer than that. In Central Park, the woman that beat me was a pro, and she was 10 years younger than me. So I was really running sort of in this invincible, macho, I call it the warrior queen, odd, which is very much, you know, it was my defense growing up, because I really felt unseen, unworthy, unloved, and I felt like I had to super perform. And if I won a race, I was loved for like 10 seconds and then it would go away. So I very much was in this warrior queen mode where I was overcoming my fears with Ironman and ultramarathons and sometimes, you know, winning them or placing overall. And I always have identified with marginalized people. I felt marginalized growing up. I always have been the champion of people that have been bullied or ostracized or marginalized. So I felt a calling to go to Chechnya. I went there with the man who started this disabled running track club. And I had worked with blind people. Actually, I led a blind climber to the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro. I had also led people in the New York City Marathon who were in wheelchairs. So I had done a lot of work with disabled people. And I felt a calling not only to go to Chechnya to help people medically, psychologically, psychiatrically, but we also started a running club there for the disabled kids as well. So for me, it was just reflex. You know, my family didn't want me to go. A lot of people said, why am I going to help terrorists? And then I eventually did work to bring three of the boys back to get medical care who had lost arms, legs, part of their penises blown off. A horrible, horrible, horrible injuries as a result of being in the Second Chechen War. I had people say to me, why are you bringing terrorists here? You know, they're not going to want to leave. And these were like salt of the earth, kind, simple, loving farm people. They all had farms and they came here and they got their medical care and they wanted to go back home and they were not terrorists, you know? So for me, it was reflex. I know it's maybe hard to understand, but for me, it was just like going home. You know, going home to me was a war of avoiding where the next explosion was. And in Chechnya, it was no different. So for me, it was going home in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah, understandable. How long were you over there?
So I was only there 10 days and we were constantly, the only reason we got in was because a KGB agent was with us. He was with us. He shadowed us the whole time. He basically hated me because I did care about the Chechens and I did provide medical and psychiatric and psychological care to them. And he poisoned me probably like the fifth day I was there. And I knew pretty much immediately, as if I was my own emergency room patient, that I had been poisoned. And given the severity of my symptoms, I was in bed for 3 days. If I tried to get up out of bed, I fell. I never had falling issues or balance issues. I had projectile vomiting of blood and diarrhea with blood. I had really high fever. I couldn't eat for at least 3 days. I lost 10 pounds. And at that time, I was in incredible shape. I'm 5'6". Then I weighed 110 pounds. I got down to 100 pounds then. I almost died there. And there was no international doctors. Doctors Without Borders had been there. And one of their female physicians had been kidnapped and killed. So they left. So I was the only help that was really there. You know, it was a genocide. People were just as sick as me. So
I have to stop real quick and ask you. So you're saying the guy who was hired to help you was the same guy who poisoned you?
Yeah. So, I mean, help, quote unquote. I mean,
yes.
He wasn't there to help us. He basically stole all our money. I had brought $3,000 to give to the Chechens to try to help them. At one point, the person I was with started protecting him. He stole clothes that we brought for the Chechens. And then the person I was with started protecting our passports because that was the next that was going to go. But he wasn't there to protect us. So, I mean, this is the game that Putin plays, right? The man that I was with has had a long relationship with this KGB agent. And I didn't know he was a KGB agent until I figured it out myself. So he was presented to me as a sports Reuters journalist, which is what he was. But he also was a KGB agent. And they had a long embedded relationship that I don't even know about, but I do know that the man that I went with to Chechnya, who was the head of this disabled running club, helped this person get into college in America, Queens, helped him get housing in Coney Island, and, you know, facilitated what I'm sure is spying on our country. I mean, this is what he did. He was a professional killer. I mean, I've never looked into someone's eyes and seen no soul. And I figured out really quickly because I've dealt with people that kill people and are sociopaths that this was a professional killer. And he was not interested in our helping people. He was not interested in any of it. He was there really to supervise us and to make sure that we did, I think, as little as we could do. So it's complicated. It is very complicated, but no, he was there very much to try to minimize our impact. And at one day we met this lovely Chechen deaf refugee who had started this school. She had literally a mud room. It was like a house built of mud, and it was one room. And this KGB agent was with us when she served us tea, and she was so proud that she had built the school for other deaf Chechen refugees. We started a race there. It was the first, what we believe is the first time Muslims ran against terrorism. And this woman was one of the Chechens who ran this race. It was a 5K. And a government car, and I wasn't in the country at this time. This was reported to me. A government car rolled over her and killed her. And the message was to the Chechens, never have this race again. And they never did. So, I mean, wow. This very much was orchestrated by the person that I was with. This was his MO. So,
yeah. Wow. Now, just for context, can you explain to me a KGB agent? What is that?
So KGB agent is like a CIA agent. They're basically So it's like Putin. So I can look there in my book, there's a whole chapter on Putin called Victim More Sent a Perpetrator. He aspired to be a KGB agent. He went to KGB school. You go to KGB school. So first he became a lawyer. Just a little, I can give a little background of Putin, which is, it's a very complicated story. There's two stories. One was that he was born out of wedlock, and then this woman married a man who was abusive, and then she sent Putin back to her parents, and then her parents couldn't deal with him, so they gave him to this couple who had lost two children during the siege of Leningrad. And those are actually Putin's parents today. And that here is this man that is abandoned, betrayed, handed off like a football, right? That is not wanted, has a mother who's ambivalent, then is given to this family. So the family that he was given to, they had survived the siege of Leningrad, which was in World War II. And the mother almost died from starvation. The father had been on the front and came home to find her body, her corpse on a wheelbarrow with other dead people. And he said, wait, she's still breathing. And he took her body and resuscitated her. And she eventually survived. But then one of their biological sons died from starvation and diphtheria, and another son died. And then they were given Putin. And then he grew up in this horrible, horrible post-war environment in Leningrad. He grew up in a one-room apartment with like 12 other families. He was a skinny, scrawny kid. He was bullied, made fun of. He was a hooligan. He would fight people on the subway. And it was very much about him having this macho bravado to cover up his vulnerabilities and his sense of loss and not being wanted as a child. And he eventually went to law school, then KGB school. He wanted to be a KGB agent internationally, but apparently he wasn't that good of a student at KGB school. So he stayed in Russia, and then he was brought into amazing power. And so that just gives you a background of what a KGB agent is. And they're basically taught to kill people. I believe I was poisoned with man-made anthrax, and both Russia and America had stockpiled man-made anthrax for biological warfare. And they agreed to stop, but Russia continued to stockpile it. And this is, you know, what you learn in KGB school.
Wow, wow, wow. So insane.
Yes.
So insane.
Yes.
Now, when you were poisoned, how long did it take you to get over being poisoned with anthrax?
I'm still dealing with the consequences of being poisoned. When someone's poisoned, there's always sequelae. But really, for 3 years, so I went there in 2005, almost died there. But for 3 years, from 2005 to 2008, I lived in a liminal space closer to death than life. I couldn't get out of bed. I could barely lift my head. Because I'm a really resilient, determined person, somehow I got myself to work. It was a block away, like just walking a block. Here's this ultra endurance athlete that couldn't walk a block. Like I would walk a block and have to rest for like an hour. It had tremendous, I had pneumonia 100 times. I had GI parasitic infections for 12 years. I developed 20 food allergies, never had a food allergy in my life. And then developed a chronic immunosuppressive disorder, which I still have. And I have consequences from that as well. But, you know, I'm a very determined person. I'll leave no rock unturned. So I had to do a lot of alternative medicine that's actually illegal in this country. But through my education with being poisoned and other people that had been poisoned, like the post office people here in New York City who were poisoned with anthrax, I learned how to fight it. You know, with thieves as an example, it's an essential oil that kills anthrax. And I did many, many detoxes, but one of them was a heavy, heavy, high dose detox with thieves, which is an essential oil. Yes. So no, it's had ramifications that I still live with today. Although I would say right today, I'm probably 80% better, but really for 3 years, I was closer to death than life.
Wow. Has that experience alone made you bitter, angry at the Russians who did this to you? I mean, like, I'm just trying to understand, like, your mindset in getting through this and even where you are today.
So I think I was very upset with this particular person, especially when I heard that he killed the salt of this earth, death Chechen refugee who started a school for other deaf Chechen refugees and brutalized her, like run over her body when she's running a race against terrorists. I mean, it's just like outrageous. I certainly was enraged and angry with, you know, what he did to me as well for a long time. But I feel that my work here in the world and in my life is to overcome this type of tragedy and this type of darkness that I think we're all capable of, unfortunately, but that I want to help people that are marginalized and ostracized and often suffer from undiagnosed psychiatric illness, to get the psychiatric illness that they deserve and not to resort to retaliation and violence. Like, I could have tried to retaliate and I didn't. I mean, I did have an encounter with him, I should say, where he walked in on me in the bathroom. So we were sharing a house. It was a general's house in Ingushetia, which is the neighboring province from Chechnya. And I was in the bathroom. He walked in on me in the bathroom and he told me to get out. And I told him, don't talk to me like that. If you talk to me, you show me respect. You don't talk that way. That's embarrassing. And, you know, I refused to get out of the bathroom.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm the type, probably not the wisest move. You know, this man was barely 5 foot tall. He was like a Napoleon. He's barely 5 foot tall. He had an issue with his height. He was very angry. He was very angry with the Chechens. They also project and complicate things. So for instance, he had told the man that I was with that the Chechens hated me and the Chechens loved me. Like, I was always playing with the Chechen girls and giving them like clothes and gifts, and they were teaching me Russian lessons and Chechen lessons. And so it's always like a projection. It's a denial, deflection, and projection. And I knew the Chechens knew exactly who he was. I could see it in their eyes. And we had an interpreter, but I could see how they recoiled from him. They knew exactly who he was and why he was there.
Yeah.
So, but you know, he was telling the person I was with that they didn't like me when they didn't like him. So this is what they very much do. It's all projection and deflection, but no, I feel like I won't live my life with bitterness. I feel like the paradox is that I had this spiritual awakening from being poisoned. And what I learned was to slow down, to accept my vulnerabilities, to accept that my body's aging and it's not perfect, to accept that I am a human being with frailties, but yet I am interconnected to everyone in the world, and what we do or don't do has consequences. And I feel impassioned to try to decrease the gun violence that's happening in our world. I mean, just yesterday, I was on Script News with the Kansas City Super Bowl championship parade mass shooting.
Yes.
And you know, ironically, it was the 6-year anniversary of the Parkland shooting, where 17 students and teachers were killed. And that Parkland shooter suffered from hearing voices and was bullied and ostracized, was given up by his parents had died and he was adopted. And here again, as a kid who's unwanted, shuffled around, and his biological mother was the only one who stabilized him. I mean, this is a kid that was completely isolated and alone and bullied and ostracized. His stepbrother also bullied him. In a moment, he chooses to retaliate and, you know, probably regrets that for the rest of his life. I mean, I listened to the videotape of him after the shooting. He did regret it. So, no, I just feel more impassioned to help people, and that I won't live my life with bitterness or anger, because in my mind, that's what this person wanted. I mean, he clearly wanted me dead. And I think because I was in such incredible physical health, and also because I'm a medical doctor, I could put the medical pieces of the puzzle together. I mean, it took me, so I was poisoned 2005, 2010, I had enough strength to begin to sit up in my computer and start investigating my symptoms and then symptoms of people that had been poisoned with anthrax. So our military was vaccinated with anthrax, and many of the men died from heart attacks. Many of the women developed very similar symptoms to me with chronic immunosuppression symptoms. I had weird rash, horrible rashes, not feeling, you know, feeling like a car had hit you. I mean, just devastatingly no energy. Many of my symptoms were similar. And he had probably put the poison in my food or drink.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And at the time I developed flu-like symptoms. And then 3 days later, I developed these severe symptoms, and that's characteristic of anthrax poisoning, which is you develop flu-like symptoms, and then 3 days later, most people die.
Yeah.
And then it looks like food poisoning, because by the time you think of anthrax, so that's the other story here, which is anthrax, because it has been now become biological weapon. Anthrax is a simple bacteria that is in the ground, and that's found in sheep. So often sheep herders get it from handling sheep in their skin. And when people are diagnosed with anthrax poisoning, there currently is no test as a sequelae. So it's only if you're acutely infected when you're septic, which means you have an infection in your blood. So that would have been when I was in Chechnya. You have to think about it, which is most people aren't going to think about it unless you're in Russia or in the Middle East, where it's more endemic to the soil. And then you have to draw the blood and culture the blood to look for anthrax. So I actually found someone at the NIH in Bethesda, Maryland, who was trying to get a blood test to detect anthrax many years after being poisoned. And she said after 3 years, you no longer had antibodies. And I think by the time I found her, it was 2012, and I didn't have antibodies for it. So, but I don't even know if she has marketed that. This was all like research. She was doing research with people who had been poisoned with anthrax, like the post office people and myself.
Yes.
You know, and Western doctors are ignorant with anthrax. They don't know about it. They misinformed me. I had the leading GI infectious specialist in Manhattan say, "Oh, come into my office, I'll test for it." And then he said, "Oh, wait, there is no test for it." So things like that, which was their Western doctors are ignorant when it comes to anthrax. And I really had to do all this digging and research. And it's in my book. And I published medical papers on it as well, where I put the pieces of the puzzle together. And I realized the best medical guess that it was man-made anthrax. I should also say, I had Rife testing. So a Rife machine works on energy. So everything has energy. Certain bacteria have a certain vibrational frequency. So I had biological testing on a Rife machine, meaning from my hair, morning sputum, and fingernails. And she's the one that detected I had man-made anthrax all throughout my body. And that was in, I believe that was in 2010. So, and then I did more research to make sure that that was accurate.
Wow. Wow. You have definitely been through a lot, because it was after that that you ended up having breast cancer, correct?
Yes, yes, yes. So 2001, I was a first responder. 2005, I was poisoned with anthrax, I believe. And then 2017, yes, I developed breast cancer. Yes. Yeah. And had a mastectomy. Yes.
Yeah. My goodness. My goodness. All of this then is what inspired you to write the book that has brought us here today.
Yes, very much so.
Tell me about the book.
Yes, I would love to. It's my baby. It's my labor of love. I, you know, as a doctor, I didn't really know how to write. So it was my passion. I could write psychoanalytically, which is very different writing, and medically, but not creative writing or for lay people writing. It's an art. And so I went back to school. I took classes at Sarah Lawrence, which is here in New York, to write, and learned how to write. You know, initially I didn't even know how to type or use the computer. I remember I would handwrite everything and send it to this lovely man in the Philippines who would type things for me. So that's where I began, which is at the very like basics here. And I was determined to write this book because like you and your story, which is so inspiring and has such grit and perseverance and love, I wanted to write my book just to inspire one person to say, look, if I can go through all of this, and I have, and I'm still, you know, I'm not a perfect person, but I'm a loving person. I try to help my brothers and sisters. I try to make a difference in the world. And you can use adversity to transcend it to make you a better person. And I really feel like, ironically, being poisoned was this paradoxical gift where I changed as a person. I couldn't push my body anymore the way I used to. I couldn't super achieve anymore, really. So really, I went from living in the phenomenal world, which is the materialistic transactional world, more into the noumenal world, which is more of the spiritual invisible world, where what matters to me is being connected with other people. What matters to me is helping other people with depression or psychosis or loss to transcend those feelings into joy, harmony, and bliss. I found those things as a result of being poisoned, and I certainly didn't have those, not harmony and joy. I didn't really have those feelings before I was poisoned. What I had was super achieving, feeling worthy, and then it all very quickly dissolving. And I wrote my book to try to say, if you're suffering from mental illness, please get help. Please get help. There are people that care, like me. And leave no rock unturned. Get help. There is a TED Talk. Aaron Stark has this TED Talk called I Was Almost a School Mass Shooter. And it talks about how he was bullied, ostracized. He was made fun of because he was overweight. He had a family that constantly dislocated, and he had to move from school to school to school, so he couldn't make friends if he wanted to. And his family didn't have the means to feed him well or to dress him in proper clothing. And he felt bitter and enraged and angry, as we all were. But then poor decision was planning to go to his high school and be a school shooter. He went next door to say goodbye to his neighbor. His neighbor looked in his eyes, saw something was really off, said, hey, something's not right here. Come in. I want to talk to you. Fed him food. And this is his TED Talk, Aaron Stark. He said, because of that kindness, one simple act of kindness, loving kindness, he didn't go to school and wasn't a mass shooter. And this is what my book is about, how all of us in society are responsible for every mass shooting, for any gun violence. What we do or don't do has ramifications. If we worry about our personal safety, and if we see someone who's being ostracized, shunned, bullied, and don't reach out to that person, all you have to do is say, hi, how are you? Smile, show some just human kindness. It doesn't have to be a lot. That this can make the difference in someone's world from making a really poor impulsive decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Remind us where we can find your book at. Where's the best place for us to send anybody interested, and remind us of the title?
Yeah, so the title is a mouthful. I tried to get it changed, but my academic publishers, Rutledge, wouldn't let me change it. I'll say the whole title. But if you remember Desire for Destruction and my name, Nina Cerfolio, on Amazon, it comes right up. The name is Psychoanalytic and Spiritual Perspectives on Terrorism, Desire for Destruction. And if you remember Desire for Destruction, Nina Cerfolio, on Amazon, it comes right up.
Okay, perfect. Well, I will be sure that a link directly to your book on Amazon is left in the show notes for anybody interested.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. Of course. And you know, honestly, thank you so much for being here today, for sharing your story and all the absolute just craziness that has comprised your story. I mean, my goodness. I mean, I listened to you think of it, and I'm like, this sounds like some type of Die Hard movie or something. But, you know, yes. But, you know, it's just though, it's your amazing outlook on life and the way that you see people, the way that you see all the situation, that makes you so amazing. And I just appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin. And I say right back at you because I'm inspired by your incredible grit, perseverance, beauty, humanity, and everyone can learn as well from to be inspired to overcome such incredible adversity that I can't even imagine, actually. Like, you astound me. Your beauty, your love, your kindness, what you're doing on your podcast. If we have one person today, I'm honored. People like you is what inspires me and keeps me going.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That honestly means so much to me. Coming from you, I appreciate that so much. Again, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Kevin. I hope you have a beautiful day. And it was my honor to spend my birthday with you. So.
That's right. Absolutely. Yes. We all have to remember wishing you a happy birthday. And my goodness. And for you listening today, my hope is, as always, that you have been entertained, but more so that you've been impacted. Something said today that will impact your life from this day forward. Remember, if you liked today's episode, be sure to share it with a friend. Spread the news of this incredible woman who we just got to hear her story, always in the hope that it will leave an impact on your life. My name is Kevin Lowe, and this is Grit, Grace, and Inspiration. Get out there and enjoy the day.